Representative Shelley Pingree on the sequester, partisan politics, and getting things done in Congress. Shelley Pingree is in her third term as Maine's first district representative in Congress. This session, she's introduced legislation to support local farmers, help servicemen and women who have suffered sexual assault, and expand higher education opportunities to new veterans. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and today on Maine Calling, it's your chance to discuss these and other issues of the day with Congresswoman Pingree. Share your comments and questions by emailing talk at mpbn.net, tweeting at Maine Calling, posting a comment to our Facebook page, or just give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Representative Shelley Pingree on current events and what is and isn't getting done in Congress. This is Maine Calling.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listener contributions and by Roosevelt Campobello International Park, a legacy of friendship between two great nations, free and open to the public, FDR.net. And by the Clean Bedroom Organic Bedding Showroom in Kittery, helping Mainers sleep healthy since 2004, also in Portland at Furnitura and online at thecleanbedroom.com.
And Representative Pingree joins us from the House studio on Capitol Hill. Thank you so much for taking the time. I know when Congress is in session, it's not always the easiest thing to find 45 minutes, so I really appreciate it.
Me too. I'm happy it worked out. Thank you for having me.
I'd like to start out by discussing some of the news of the day. Just last week, student loan rates went up because Congress failed to take action that would have prevented the interest rate hike. Now that you're back in Washington, I know there's some movement in the Senate. Is there meaningful activity in the House on this issue right now?
Well, not yet. I'm a little at odds with the House leadership on this. They have a plan, frankly, that would create an adjustable rate up to 10.5% that would generate a profit, which then they would use to pay down the deficit. So the Senate plan keeps it at 3.4%, so a much more reasonable rate for the next year for students. And I don't think we should make money off the backs of the students to pay down the deficit. I mean, it's hard enough to pay your way through college. It's hard enough for families to support the cost of going to school today, and for young people who come out with horrendous debt. I hear about this issue all the time from students, families, the educational institutions themselves. So I hope we can come to a resolution here, but I'm certainly not in favor of the House proposal. And I do hope we do something about it, because you're right, the rates already went into effect on July 1st. We can make it retroactive and we can fix the problem, but we need to get it done at least by the end of the summer.
And when you say you support the Senate plan, is this put forward by Senate leadership? Because I know that Senators Collins and King are supporting a bill that would the Treasury's 10-year borrowing rate plus 1.85%. That's not the proposal you're discussing, right?
There's one that actually keeps the rates at 3.4%. I mean, the truth is the Senate will negotiate out whatever they can get, and the House will do something, frankly, that I don't appreciate. But if we're lucky, we'll get them into conference and we'll find some middle ground. So, I probably won't have the chance to vote on the specific proposal that the Senate does. But I know our two senators are on the right track of understanding this issue, that we shouldn't be trying to make money off of student loans and then using that money to pay down the deficit. Like I said, it's just hard enough to get through college the way it is.
OK, well, let's turn to Egypt, to the military overthrow of President Morsi and the violence that has followed. How do you believe the U.S. should respond to the events in Egypt?
You know, that's a complicated issue, as we all know, and we've all been watching it closely. I guess I follow the sort of general theory here that, we can't be in favor of abandoning the democratic process. As much as people didn't perhaps like the ruler that was in place, we do have a United States law that prohibits us from sending aid to countries where there's been a military coup. And it's hard to not argue, it's hard to argue that this isn't a military coup. It is. And we send a lot of aid to Egypt, and our U.S. aid money should be giving us some kind of leverage. So I think they have to go a long way to show us that it's you know, not a case of the military taking over, get back to democratic elections before we can be highly favorable of this.
So some, including Senator John McCain, have called for the suspension of U.S. aid. Are you not quite ready to state that outright, but are leaning in that direction?
I'm not ready to pull the plug. Because I do think we have to support them, encourage them. This is, as we know, been a very tumultuous time. That said, there's a variety of people in Congress who are now saying, you know, we can't be in the position of supporting a military coup, and we have to make that clear. So I go along with that.
Mm-hmm. Representative Pingree, how has the sequester affected Maine?
You know, in so many ways, I think that people just don't see. You know, it's one of those things. I guess we all watch too many disaster films. You want to see, you know, the sequester, like a tidal wave coming through and washing us all away and people saying, oh, my God, now I understand what that did. And it's just, it's not exactly like that. But it is insidious. It has the potential to do deep, long-term damage. And I think people will increasingly feel it in a whole variety of ways. I happened to be just before we headed down on Monday, I was down in the Kittery Shipyard. The New Hampshire people seem to insist on calling it the Portsmouth Shipyard, but we know better. And the New Hampshire delegation and the Maine delegation were down there because the Joint Chiefs of Staff leader, General Dempsey, was there to do a tour of the shipyard. Good news is he always anyone who comes there is always impressed with the quality of work and realize what a strategic importance it has. But one of the critical things was it was the day before the first sequester layoff for the civilian employees at the shipyard. And you know, it's hard not to argue that in the end this could easily just cost us money. And even, you know, General Dempsey said that Secretary Hagel, Department of Defense, is doing everything they can to eliminate the need for the sequesters. But there will be 11 days, one day a week for the next 11 weeks, that people who work at the yard will have to stay home for a day. They tried to segregate what's a critical worker from what's maybe not such critical personnel. But the fact is, if people weren't critical there, they already would have been laid off. I mean, every job is important there, and everyone who has to take that day personally is losing 11 days out of their paycheck. And for a lot of people, that's a big challenge when you got to pay the mortgage and keep your kids in school and all the other things that people have to do. So, you know, that's one of those examples, and there are other federal employees around the state who are being affected by the sequester. I sit on the Agriculture Appropriations Committee. We've dealt with the issue of will there be enough safety inspectors and slaughterhouse facilities. I mean, it's every department is affected by what is basically just an across-the-board cut. It can't be done in a sensible way because of the way the law was written. It was called the Budget Control Act. I voted against it in the beginning because I just don't think that Congress is supposed to govern in this way, to say, you know, if we can't come to a resolution, we'll just hack things off, you know, in any way we can possibly do it. It affects potential contracting on future ships at the Bath Ironworks. It certainly will have a long-term impact on our defense readiness, but it is, like I said, across the board. And now that we're going through the budgeting process, we haven't even begun to get into some of the areas, you know, and move the budgets to the floor, the bills to the floor on the appropriations bill, where we could see deep impacts to education, to health and human services, you know, across the board. And the thing is, if Congress doesn't figure out how to sit down and create a real budget and work with each other about what we should cut and what we shouldn't cut, this actually, it kicks in again for next year. And we have spent all of this year trying to figure out, you know, how to take out the fat to keep the, you know, the safety inspectors in the slaughterhouses. Well, next year there won't be any quote-unquote fat to, you know, to find. So anyway, it's kind of an insider Congress conversation. The word sequester always baffles people what's it about. But it is the result of Congress being unwilling to follow its normal process, to work through a committee system, to come to an agreement, to make reasonable cuts in areas where we should be cutting, and then move ahead with the business of government. But I think it's going to have a huge long-term impact on everything from the money we put into roads and bridges and education and health research. Things are vitally important to keeping a strong economy.
And that next big deadline is September 1st, correct?
It is. And, you know, please do not ask me to predict what Congress will do next. I'm just as baffled sometimes as everyone is on the outside.
All right. Well, thank you. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number is 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. You can email us, talk@mpbn.net. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We already have calls going in, and we're going to go to Jonathan in Monmouth. Jonathan, go ahead. You're on Maine Calling with Congresswoman Shelley Pingree.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
My wife works at Johnny's Selected Seeds, which is a Maine seed company, and many of the farmers that she works with have questions about what's the status of the farm bill and how it might affect Maine farmers.
Congresswoman Pingree?
Yeah. Sure. Oh, wow. My favorite question, the first question. Thank you very much. And tell your wife thank you for working at Johnny's Selected Seeds. I think all of us in Maine should be very proud of the work they've done in that country, the way company and the way their seeds are known around the country, and just the, you know, the great vision of Rob Johnson to start the place. So anyway, that's a wonderful Maine business, and the Farm Bill is yet another great mystery of being in Congress. I've been lucky enough to serve on the Agriculture Committee, and now on the Agriculture Appropriations Committee, and really tried to work as closely as possible with Maine farmers and farm businesses to look to the reauthorization of the Farm Bill and think about how we could do it in such a way that really assists in this incredibly impressive growth we've had in Maine of small farmers, medium-sized farmers, people who are creating more products from their farms, traditional farm families who are able to hang on to the farm a little longer, the growth in farmers markets. I don't think I have to tell a single person in Maine. It's just been impressive to see what's going on. But we are basically, you know, tend to be the tail end of who gets the assistance from the Farm Bill and who gets the kind of support that people need, whether it's helping them to put up a hoop house or fixing the creamery to be more compliant or to get healthier food in the school lunch. So we wrote a bill in my office and worked with a whole variety of our colleagues really on both sides of the aisle to attempt to attach amendments in the committee, to get amendments added in the Senate and in the House. The Senate passed the Farm Bill handily, and it came to the House floor. And I mean, first off, last year we couldn't even get the majority party, the Republicans, to bring it up on the floor. This year they brought it to the floor, and in what turned out really to be a colossal disaster, they couldn't even get enough of their own members to vote for their version of the Farm Bill to move it through. So it's the, you know, if there is sort of a Hollywood gossip column of Washington, it is the gossip of the day is what's going to happen with the Farm Bill and are we ever going to see it move forward? This week, there's some talk that they will split up the food programs, which is what includes SNAP benefits. SNAP is the other name for food stamps and the, you know, that kind of food assistance from the actual assistance to farmers and some of the subsidies that go to the big farmers in other parts of the country, that they might split those into two. But, you know, the latest talk is that there's not enough votes to move that forward, and that's not the way the Senate passed it. So not to get into the obscure parliamentary issues around it, but it's just complicated that we can't pass a bill. And my editorial comment on it would be it's really tragic because this bill only comes up for reauthorization every 5 years. Congress has worked hard really for 2 years to try to bring about some consensus about how to reduce some of those enormous subsidies that go to the big crops like corn and soybeans and how to put some means testing in there to make sure you're not just giving money to some of the wealthiest farmers and landowners and big corporations that don't need the assistance and how to move it to some of the places where we really could improve our food system. And there really has been a fair amount of work on that. And it's depressing that we can't come together and work on it together. It was classically the one or one of the pieces of legislation that people would always talk about. You know, this is bipartisan. We work well on both sides of the aisle. And frankly, the rank and file members have. And I've got some great Republican colleagues who have worked with me on these issues on local food and farming. But frankly, we just can't get it to move. So I'm hoping that they'll feel the pressure. And before we take a recess in August, we'll actually see it come up again. And it will go to the Senate for conference. And someday we'll have a final version of the bill.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for your call. We have a related email from Nancy, and she asks, what you think of the idea of splitting, you know, the SNAP program, the food stamp program, the voting on that from the rest of the agricultural part of the farm bill. Would you support that, or as you said, you really don't think it has much traction anyway?
You know, it's a good question, and we've talked a fair amount about it with some of our colleagues. Honestly, the bill is supposed to be coming out shortly, and we haven't seen what it would look like, you know, what the actual farm bill would do. The leadership said that if they brought this split farm bill to the floor, it wouldn't it would be what they call a closed bill, so it wouldn't allow for any of our amendments. And we have lots of great amendments that we've been working on with colleagues. So, A, it would take away that opportunity for us, and that is very unsettling. And frankly, unsettling, again, for people on both sides of the aisle. You know, getting your amendment on isn't a partisan issue. You know, whether I agree with you or not, you should have the right to put your own amendment on, or at least take it to a vote with your colleagues. I think the concern has been, and I share this concern, that you know, the food programs, the SNAP benefits, are where the contentious debate is and where many of our Tea Party colleagues, you know, really feel that we should take government out of this process and no longer provide people with food assistance. The reality is, in this tough economy, we've seen increasing numbers of people have been really struggling. Some of them are senior citizens who just barely get by, families with children. I would be, and I have been very opposed to cuts in that program and cutting back any of that aid to Maine, because I think it's vitally necessary. So I think one of the arguments of people who worry about splitting it is that you lose a vital compromise with the farmers who grow the food and the people who are in need. And once you split that up, a lot of the agreements could fall apart. So I'm kind of waiting to see what happens by the day.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions, more of your comments and questions for Congresswoman Pingree. This is Maine Calling.
I'm also worried that if I make it out, that's like every time you make it out okay, that's like further down the road you go of thinking that you're always going to make it out okay.
Tune in for Diary of a Bad Year, a war correspondent's dilemma. From NPR's Kelly McEvers and me, Jay Allison, for Transom.org. Presented by PRX in collaboration with NPR.
You can hear that program Friday afternoon at 1 o'clock. MPBN is searching for an experienced campaign leader to guide MPBN's strategic campaign to transform public media in Maine with initiatives that will serve audiences of today and tomorrow with essential and valued programming and services. The successful candidate will be energetic and enthusiastic about the potential and mission of public broadcasting with a proven track record for transformational fundraising. For more information, a complete description about the position and application instructions, visit mpbn.net and click on About. Thank you. Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by the Maine Humanities Council, creating community through conversation, mainehumanities.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Congresswoman Shelley Pingree. She serves on the powerful House Appropriations Committee and joins us from a studio in the nation's capital. We'd like you to join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We have a couple emails here. This is from Jason. It seems plain to me and most of the people I know that corporate interests are really who control this country. What does Ms. Pingree think about this, and what does she think should be done to give people back the power they should have with their votes?
Well, this is certainly a reasonable question and a big concern of most people I talk to. I don't think I've ever met a person who was in favor, maybe one I've met, I don't know, but of the decision of the Supreme Court on Citizens United and the dramatic change in the influence of money in politics over the last decade, but particularly since that decision. You know, I came to Congress after spending, you know, time in a state like Maine where We have public financing of elections, so you can really diminish the amount of money that's spent in politics, but also really just the amount that each candidate has to go out and raise. And so I came with that interest in my first 2 years when the Democrats were in control of the House. We had public hearings on the Fair Elections Now bill, which is actually a public financing bill that's very much modeled after how we do clean elections in Maine. I've signed on to virtually every constitutional amendment to deal with Citizens United, onto the Disclose Act, which would, if we can't pass all those changes, at least disclose would give people more information about what money is being spent to influence candidates or to lobby Congress. So, you know, I wholeheartedly agree. This is a big issue, and it doesn't really matter what area you tackle. The amount of money that is available to either lobby candidates or influence Congress, whether it's you know, energy policy and the oil industry or agricultural policy and the, you know, chemical fertilizer industry, you know, healthcare. I mean, it's every topic you deal with, and you really have to separate out, you know, who's trying to lobby on which issue, how's the money being spent, and what's the right thing to do. So I think it's tricky for everybody to navigate in Congress, but I also really think this is a system that has to change.
All right, back to the calls. This is Thea in Bath. Thea, go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, thank you. Shelley, I was wondering what are you going to do to ensure federal civil rights protections for lesbians and gays, to eliminate discrimination in employment, housing, public accommodations, et cetera, so there will be protections for us everywhere as we have in Maine?
Thank you for your question, and I'm very proud to be from the state of Maine, and to be able to say that we're from one of the states that now supports marriage equality, and particularly in light of the recent Supreme Court decision that makes it far more fair for those people who are married to access the benefits that they deserve. I think you're asking about ENDA, the Employee Non-Discrimination Act, which has been before Congress in the past and needs to be passed again. I'm a wholehearted supporter of that and look forward to the opportunity to cast a vote on that. Again, you know, one of the I don't want to kind of harp on this point, but, you know, one of the complicated factors in the way a legislative body works, it's true of the Maine legislature or Congress or, you know, virtually any state in the nation, is the majority party decides who will be a committee chair, what will be the legislative agenda, and basically what bills will come to the floor. So I got the chance to serve 2 years in a Democratic majority, and now I'm currently serving in a Republican majority. And, you know, you don't just sign up for the times you're in power. You have to be there to, you know, oppose somebody else's ideas and support your ideas, whatever comes about. And I just say that in preface to the fact that our Republican colleagues are not interested in bringing the Employment Non-Discrimination Act to the floor, ENDA. So I do not think I'll get a chance to vote on it in this session of Congress, but I do hope there will be a time that we can. And I do think, you know, people have you know, come to realize this is a really important issue of civil rights that we have to deal with in this country. And I really hope we're able to do that on a federal level. I was lucky enough to be allowed to vote on this issue when I was a state legislator, and look forward to doing it again. So thanks for your question.
All right. And I should probably say this is a good time to mention that tomorrow's topic on Maine Calling is Maine's gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender community and the challenges they face and the resources available to them. So that's just tomorrow on Maine Calling. We're going to go
good
now
timing.
To yeah, Bill in Hope. Bill, go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
I'm Bill in Hope, and this is for Shelley. And we appreciate your support on the federal public school, charter school bills. But I just I also appreciate that you're very vigilant in looking for things that discriminate against Maine, and I think we have a case here. Now, when the public schools, public charter schools started, the federal startup money was to help these new public schools get started. But now that Maine is finally joining that movement, the federal money is going to clone successful, what will I call them, big box charter schools, and not to help the mom and pop schools anymore, like ours. And That's what we need. Is there anything you can do to help us by restoring the original purpose of the federal support for charter schools, the startup funds?
Well, it's certainly a good question, and I don't know that I have an immediate answer for you, but I'm certainly happy to ask my office to do a little research on it. I think what you're bringing up is that there's been a lot of concern raised about some of the for-profit education that has sprung up and not really considered to be, you know, as good of an opportunity for our kids as, you know, might be more costly. I'm a strong supporter of public education. And, you know, think particularly in a low population state like ours, where we have a lot of rural communities, we have to do everything we can to strengthen our public schools. Some of the federal laws have allowed for more opportunities for charter schools. And I know it's been an object of great debate within the Maine legislature, and some of those decisions get made there. But I'll do a little research and happy to give you some more information on this. And I appreciate your question.
All right. Thank you, Bill. You know, we have an email and a bit of news from the Associated Press coming in at the same time. Just in from the Associated Press, the push to restore lower student loan interest rate fails in the U.S. Senate. For so now, the 6.8% rate is going to remain. And the email we have is from John in Bar Harbor. He says, does the increase in the college student loan interest rate affect students who have already qualified and currently have loans? My son just completed his first year of medical school. He started borrowing money a year ago and will be borrowing money for 3 more years.
Thank you for your question, and thank you to your son for going to medical school. You know, we have groups of students who come down to visit us, actually, to talk often about student loans and about the process of going to medical school and graduate medical education. Many of them come from UNE because that is our one medical school in Maine, although we have affiliations with others. But anyway, I always say to those students how much I appreciate that they're willing to go through the process of becoming a physician, a doctor, and take on the burden of school loans. They're just, you know, they're it's a daunting task to go to that much school, to take, the responsibility of curing health problems of another human being. But on top of it, so many of them come out with literally hundreds of thousands of dollars of loans. And one of the big challenges is, in doing that, they have to make the ultimate decision of, okay, so where am I going to go practice? And when the loan debt, the debt is crushing when you come out of school, it makes it much more difficult to make that decision to say, I think I'll be a general practitioner in a small rural community in Maine, which is where we have some of the greatest shortage of doctors. So, that's kind of a side issue, but I always make a point of thanking them for being willing to take on that debt because, you know, some of them will be paying it off their entire life, particularly if they choose, you know, kind of practice that isn't as lucrative or they're not in a big city. So anyway, I think that anyone who is currently qualified for a loan will qualify under the rate that they're already under. Mostly, you know, new loans won't be handed out till the late summer. So I'm assuming we will fix this problem. I really don't think that Congress can face their constituents, you know, and tell them that we let the interest rates go so high or we took the money back for the deficit. So it will be retroactive, or any new loans don't actually get parceled out till the end of the summer. I think whatever we do will be effective. I'm discouraged. Thank you for bringing me the news of the Senate, even though they're just on the other side of the building. I hadn't heard that yet. I'm discouraged that they haven't moved ahead on this, but I certainly hope they'll keep working to get a compromise and then eventually we'll pass something in the House. I just don't, you know, this is one of those issues that, you know, shouldn't be partisan. Everybody wants their kids to go to college. Everybody has to struggle in the same system to pay off the debt. So I truly believe we'll find a solution to it.
Okay, turning back to the calls now. Ken in Searsport, you're on Maine Calling. Go ahead.
Oh, hey there. It's a pleasure to speak with you today. I was in Portland in January for the Tar Sands Rally, and Shelley, I'd like to thank you for your effort that you put forward there in bringing attention into stopping that unneeded project. It almost seems like Searsport and the rest of Maine's environment is under assault from corporate interests, and a number of us in Searsport were involved with stopping the massive LPG tank here. And recent events have shown that, you know, that was a bad idea for Searsport. I'm speaking of what happened recently in Canada, that a town very small just was unequipped to handle such a massive project. But now I'm calling about something that's probably equally as bad, and that's the Army Corps' plan to dredge Searsport Harbor and the massive amount of dredging that's not needed. And I fully acknowledge that maintenance dredging, which is a small percentage of the project, about 4%, is necessary and needs to be done.
Ken, we need to go to a break very soon. Can you ask your question, please?
Sure. My question is regarding the project, and $10 million of federal money is going to be spent on this, and in this time of fiscal austerity, and given this the question, I heard you speak about the impact to ordinary men and women working for the federal government. I mean, I'm wondering if we could have a second look at this project.
Okay. Thank you. Shelley Pingree?
All a very good question and an issue I'm very well aware of. I hear from constituents and residents from around Maine about this issue quite a bit. I have, enormous concerns about the idea of dredging there, about the dredge spoils, where they will be dumped. Obviously, that's the Penobscot Bay area, which is, you know, my home, but also an area I've represented in the legislature and now in the Congress for a long time. And, lobster fishermen and a whole variety of fishermen have a huge concern about, anything in a toxic spoil that could be dumped around there. So we are asking all the federal agencies to do a thorough environmental review of the plan. We've reached out beyond the Army Corps of Engineers to other agencies that can have an influence over this decision. And I certainly agree with the caller that a $10 million expenditure at this time, it just doesn't have any merit. Not only do we have big concerns about this particular dredge and where the spoils will be dumped, he's right. We don't have that kind of money. And I mean, in my district alone, which is only half of the Maine coast, I have a lot of communities lined up asking the Army Corps for necessary dredging, whether it's for commerce or for a variety of other issues. There's a lot of budget items for the Army Corps that need to come long before this. So, I mean, I frankly don't anticipate that they will receive the funding soon because it's not currently available to them. But we are also pushing really hard for a thorough environmental review because we share exactly these concerns.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Ken, for your call. We're going to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay tuned.
On the next Fresh Air, novelist Kate Christensen. Her memoir, Blue Plate Special, opens with a scary scene at her childhood breakfast table, and an engaging story unfolds about food and emotion. Then health writer Joe Robinson explains why we'd be better off eating a little more like our prehistoric ancestors. Her book is Eating on the Wild Side. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. Garrison Keillor and A Prairie Home Companion are coming to Bangor Saturday evening, July 27th. The performance will take place at Darling's Waterfront Pavilion on the Bangor waterfront. There are still tickets available. And just in, we now have a special package that includes premium seats and the opportunity to meet Garrison. If you do decide to attend, please use the special MPBN27 code and have Waterfront Concerts donate a portion of the sale to MPBN. For more information about the July 27th event, the MPBN27 code, and the special Meet Garrison option, visit mpbn.net and click on the Events tab, then choose A Prairie Home Companion Live in Bangor. And thanks. Join us immediately following Maine Calling at 1 o'clock for It's Your World. The speaker today is Tom Malinowski, Washington Director of Human Rights Watch. He'll discuss his recent trip to Myanmar and what to expect in this new and fragile democracy. That's It's Your World, coming up at 1 o'clock following Maine Calling here on MPBN Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today, we're speaking with Congresswoman Shelley Pingree. She is serving her third term representing Maine's 1st Congressional District. To the phones now, Bridget in Portland. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much, Jennifer. Thank you so much for taking my call, question, Congresswoman. My question is, you've been talking recently a lot about getting more women elected to office, whether that be at a local level or a federal level. And I want to know what, you know, do you think is most important for accomplishing that? And two, what difference you think that'll make in the way our government might function?
Well, thank you for your question. I probably am biased since I'm a woman. But I do think, you know, we have a gender imbalance in our country. I think something like only 17% of Congress is female, and yet, you know, over 50% of our voters are women. And I think it's there's often a bigger challenge for women to convince themselves that they should run or to raise the resources that they need. So I've over the years been involved in a whole variety of organizations that help women to understand the process of running for office, to encourage them to run, groups like Emily's List at a national level, who literally raise money for women, predominantly pro-choice Democratic women, to get elected. So I guess you could say, on the one hand, I want to ensure that we have more female colleagues. I think women do bring somewhat of a different perspective. I mean, we're all getting to be more similar in our lifestyles. But the truth is, women are more likely to have the concerns of aging parents, of daycare costs for their kids, of getting their kids eating healthy school lunches, you know, just a variety of issues that I think they bring into the conversation that are just important for us to consider. And particularly when we get into these difficult economic times and Congress has been under these budget constraints and we have to decide, you know, where do we make those cuts? And are they going to be to making sure people get a healthy breakfast and a healthy lunch every day? Are they going to be to making it possible for kids to get a college education, which has been so important for women in enhancing their economic status, and particularly for single moms and others who need to earn a decent living to raise their kids? So I just think we bring a lot into every issue, from, you know, international affairs to you know, economic issues, and I think we would just be better off if we had a little more balance. So thanks for your question.
Well, thank you, Bridget. To an email now, this is from Reed in Freedom. He says, many of us in Maine are concerned about our safety in light of the horrific events in Lac-Megantic. We believe that the rail infrastructure in our state is not able to handle these unit rains safely. I believe he meant rails. Have you plans to ask the Federal Railroad Administration or the National Safety Transportation Board to investigate the ability of our rail system to handle these rolling pipeline of millions of barrels of crude oil being shipped from North Dakota?
Well, first, thank you, Reed, for your question. And, you know, my deepest sympathy to this community and to the families. It's really horrific to have been watching over the past few days the photos, the stories, the firsthand experiences that people had. Given that this town is, I think, 10 miles from the Maine border, you know, you look at it and you think this could have been any small Maine town. It was a community on a lake. It was a Saturday night. People were out, you know, partying with each other out in the community. I mean, like, it could have been any town. And just the idea that, A, they were, you know, struck completely unaware, that clearly so many lives have been lost, that this toxic fuel is dumped into their lake and throughout their community, that, you know, 30 buildings are gone. And, I mean, it's just utter devastation. You know, I just really feel for the community and the surrounding area. And I think we're really grateful for the Maine first responders who were on the scene. I don't think there was a lot people could do in the beginning because of these massive explosions and this horrific fire. But we're all very proud of them for being right there right away and helping their Canadian neighbors. So that said, you know, getting to the big question here, that's actually an excellent suggestion to send a letter to the NSTB. National Transport and NTSB, anyway, the transportation safety people. And we've certainly been talking about in our office, you know, what role should we play in looking at this in the future? This was a Maine company, Maine Rail. And, you know, I know they're looking into criminal behavior and there could have been a mistake made. But the fact is, one of the big issues that's coming up here is that we are increasingly transporting fuel around this country. It's not unlike the issue that's come up around the pipeline. Some of these fuels are more toxic, more corrosive. There's already been stories written about these particular rail cars, which there have been previous conversations, I think I read going back to the early 90s, that said they were susceptible to punctures and, you know, not the safest way to haul fuel. So, you know, we've got this complicated issue we have to balance in our country, and it comes up frequently. We want more access to inexpensive fuel. We have states like North Dakota that are now producing more domestic fuel than ever before, and we all want to end our dependence on foreign oil. So I understand that in order to do that, we have to move it, but we can't leave this issue of transportation and safety off the table while we're doing that. I'd also say that, you know, my particular interest for the 5 years I've been in Congress really has been on investing in renewable fuels. While it's great that we now have more domestic fuel, they don't come without environmental consequences. And there's a lot of conversation about that, whether it's fracking or more oil drilling or transporting tar sands. I mean, these are real conversations we have to have. But also, we have really struggled after the first 2 years of Democratic control of the House with some of our Republican colleagues who are less willing to invest in energy conservation so that our older buildings use less energy and solar and wind power and tidal power and some of the things that could create new jobs in our state and also, you know, the kind of power that you don't have to transport around and you don't have some of these big issues. And that are renewable. You know, we will run out of any of these substances we're moving by rail or pipeline. And while now that date has been pushed back dramatically by some of the recent fines, as I said, it's very complicated. So, I'm constantly trying to encourage people to get more involved in this conversation. And we certainly will take up on that suggestion and ask for a further investigation if not enough is done on this really tragic incident.
Mm. On to Alice from Harrington. Alice, go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I have a question about the unfolding Affordable Health Care Act as relates to exchanges that will be coming in place. There are people that I know, for example, who are going to be having an adoptive child come to live with them, family member. And I was wondering, they're on Medicare, so how will that be taken care of, the child's health insurance under the new model? Thank you.
Wow, that's a really good question, and you possibly have stumped me here. I mean, anyone who's covered under Medicare is not really affected by the Affordable Care Act. I just got to think about that. I think that the exchanges won't necessarily play the same role in that situation. But I would say first, we have a page on our website that directs anybody who's interested in questions about the Affordable Care Act or healthcare in general to a lot more resources where you can ask a question of us or the federal government. And there's actually a lot of resources as the exchanges become available and enrollment for the health insurance marketplace, which starts on October 1st, gets closer and closer. So I encourage anyone who wants to look at our website, which is www.pingree.house.gov, call my office or call Mike Michaud or any of the senators' offices, because all of us are very dedicated to making sure that, you know, we create those opportunities when you have a question about anything to do with the federal government, that we're there directly to help you with constituent service.
Well,
I'm certainly happy to do that.
Alice, thank you for your call. And Representative Pingree, we will add that your website to Maine Calling's Facebook page for anybody who wants to do that. We need to say goodbye. Congresswoman Pingree, thank you for joining us today. Shelley Pingree is serving her third term in Congress representing Maine's 1st Congressional District. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. John Keimel ran the board, and we had help from the MPBN web team. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our podcast by visiting mpbn.net/mainecalling. Tomorrow on the program, Keith Shortall will be here for a discussion about gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people living in Maine. What challenges do they face and what resources are available to the GLBT community? I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.